2 Peter 1, verse 6, the third talk in a series on the book of 2 Peter, was presented by Ron Julian on July 8, 2012, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Peter is writing to people who have believed the gospel that Peter preaches. He reminds them that the purpose of that gospel is to lead us all to life and godliness. We have two great needs: to be freed from condemnation and death, and to be freed from the corruption of sin, becoming like God himself. And that is exactly what God is doing for us through the gospel. Peter's concerned that among his readers are false teachers. He calls them false teachers. The message of those teachers is not the gospel, and the goal of those teachers is not life and godliness. And so, Peter is seeking to reestablish the connection between believing the gospel and the pursuit of goodness. This is why he lays out this list of qualities that inevitably must be associated with faith in the gospel. I argued last week that these virtues are not just add-ons. It's not you have faith and get saved, and then you should do some of these other things as well. They are not unrelated additions to our faith. They all come from the same place that a genuine faith comes from. That is, they are all symptoms of a heart touched by God. Faith and each of these other qualities arise from a willingness to believe and follow the truth. Okay, so last week we looked at the first two of the qualities in the list. A genuine faith will give rise to the pursuit of moral excellence. God himself has an excellence far above all of us, and the purpose of the gospel is for his power to grant us a moral excellence like his own. And so we cannot really believe and embrace the gospel without recognizing that moral excellence is our great call and hope. It doesn't mean that we don't struggle with sin, but it does mean that we care about the moral excellence of God and seek to be like him. And so we will not join the false teachers in their pursuit of ungodliness. Likewise, a genuine faith and moral excellence will give rise to the quest for knowledge. Through the prophets and the apostles, God has made himself known to us. It is a moral issue. It is an issue of the heart, whether we want to know more of what God has revealed to us. Who is God? What is the great hope of our lives? What is truly good? The heart touched by God wants to know more about these things. And so we will not join the false teachers in their rejection of what God has revealed in the gospel. So that's what we've looked at so far. So I want to look at the third quality in his list next. We're going to look at three more today. I'll start reading in verse 5. Now for this very reason also, applying all diligence in your faith, provide moral excellence, and in your moral excellence, knowledge, and in your knowledge, self-control. Self-control gets mentioned a handful of times in the New Testament. It is not a word that is used a lot. It is a virtue that would have been prized by many enlightened pagans of the time. In fact, that is true of our list so far. Moral excellence, knowledge, self-control, these are all qualities that a virtuous pagan of the time would have valued. Plato, Aristotle, the Stoics, all these and many more spoke highly of self-control. Now, I'm no expert on this stuff, but what they valued, I think, as I understand it, was the concept of self-mastery. The self-controlled man is strong and free. He is free from his animal passions. The man who is a slave of his passions is to be pitied. And there's something noble about the man who does not eat too much, or who is not promiscuous, or who does not get drunk. Such a man is free. Such a man has personal strength. Well, as far as it goes, we as Christians can embrace that picture as well. I mean, that's a worthwhile picture. I think we are probably all familiar with that sense of degradation and shame that arises when we don't exercise self-control. And conversely, there can be something satisfying about saying no to ourselves in the pursuit of goodness. We feel like we are in touch with the best part of ourselves when we are not giving in to every desire that we have. But like all of the virtues discussed in the Bible, the focus is not on how our behavior makes us feel. The focus is on how we relate to God. God has a way he wants us to go. And sometimes, in order to follow God, we have to say no to ourselves. Self-control in the Bible is about saying no to myself so that I can say yes to God and to his will. And thus, it is necessarily connected to a living and genuine faith. I can't be indifferent to what God wants, and so I can't be unwilling to say no to myself if I genuinely believe this stuff. Now, like I said, the word is not used a lot in the New Testament, but we can get a few hints about its significance by looking at a couple of interesting passages. This word shows up in several lists. If I remember correctly, I think it's one of the lists in the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians. I believe self-control is one of those. But the problem with those lists is it doesn't explain it anymore. It just gives it in a list. So it's obviously something that we ought to value, but it doesn't tell us any more about what this thing is that we ought to value. But there are a few hints, I think, in a few passages in the New Testament. In Acts 24, we see that Paul is under arrest in Caesarea. He has been sent to the Roman procurator, Felix. And so in Acts 24:24, we read, "But some days later, Felix arrived with Drusilla, his wife, who was a Jewess, and sent for Paul and heard him speak about faith in Christ Jesus. And as he was discussing righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix became frightened and said, 'Go away for the present, and when I find time, I will summon you.' At the same time, too, he was hoping that money would be given him by Paul. Therefore, he also used to send for him quite often and converse with him." Okay, so Felix, the procurator, the governor at the time, has a reputation in history as being an immoral man. Drusilla, his wife that is mentioned here, was originally, as a young girl, married to someone else. And Felix wanted her and went to her and convinced her to leave her husband and marry him. The Roman historian Tacitus says that Felix practiced every kind of cruelty and lust, wielding the power of a king with all the instincts of a slave. And actually, as I understand it, there's some truth to that. Felix originally was a freedman who had been exalted to a high position by Claudius. So not a person who was in the habit of exercising much self-control or who had as much pressure to exercise self-control. So here's Paul talking to Felix about faith in Jesus Christ. He's preaching the gospel to him, and yet part of his message concerns righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come. And Felix didn't care for this at all and got scared by the whole thing. Well, I think it's very interesting. Paul is preaching the gospel to Felix. He's talking about faith in Jesus, but he also understands the man that he's talking to. This is a man who is not used to saying no to himself. What he wants, he has taken. So Paul has to make clear to him the nature of the God that he is preaching. This Jesus that he's asking him to believe in is representing a God who is calling all mankind to repent. He is asking us to see the difference between what we want and what God wants. And when you see the difference between what you want and what God wants, sooner or later, that's going to involve you saying no to yourself. A lack of self-control is not just a regrettable personal weakness. One day we are going to come under the judgment of God. There is no way to follow God and pursue righteousness without self-control. That is, without saying no to ourselves, we cannot say yes to God, because we're not heading in the same direction. 1 Corinthians 9 is the second passage I want to talk briefly about, with an interesting use of this word self-control, I think illuminating a little bit. Paul is talking about the controversial issue of eating meat sacrificed to idols. Not a controversial issue to us. This has been settled long ago. But for them at the time, this was very controversial. Is it okay for me to go to the meat market and buy meat and eat it that has been sacrificed to idols? Paul argues that on the one hand, there is nothing wrong with eating meat sacrificed to idols. It's just meat. Go ahead and eat it. The Corinthians are free to go ahead and eat that meat. But on the other hand, some of their less mature brethren believe it is wrong to eat the meat. They see it as being disobedient to God if they eat meat sacrificed to idols. What's happening then in this situation is that there are those who are hipper. There are those who understand that it is okay to eat the meat, but in their self-satisfied hipness, they are putting pressure on the ones who don't want to eat the meat. Come on, don't be uncool. You don't want to be one of those kind of people, do you? Come on, you ought to join me in eating this stuff. And what's happening then is that they are putting pressure on them to violate their conscience. They are not personally convinced that it's okay to eat the meat. So if they end up eating it, it is going to be against what they think is right. Paul's message to the hip crowd in this situation is this. Yes, in theory, you have freedom to eat this meat. But if exercising your freedom means pressuring other believers to violate their conscience, then you should limit your freedom for their sake. Not because there's anything wrong with eating the meat, but because you care about your fellow brother and sister in Christ, and you don't want to pressure them to do something that would be terribly wrong in their eyes. So, in the passage we're about to look at, Paul uses his own behavior as an example. He sees himself as one who tries to follow this practice of limiting his own freedom for the sake of other people. Even though he is free to do things, he does not always exercise that freedom because of the impact it might have on someone else. So he says when he's preaching to Gentiles, he feels free to eat like a Gentile. But when he is preaching to Jews, he limits his freedom and joins the Jews in following Jewish dietary laws. So he doesn't eat ham or anything else forbidden by the law of Moses when he is with the Jews and preaching to the Jews. This is how Paul wants the Corinthians to treat the issue of eating meat sacrificed to idols. If it is not adversely affecting anyone else, go ahead, exercise your freedom, eat. But if your freedom is leading someone else astray, then limit yourself for their sake. Okay, so now let me read the passage, having that background. This is in 1 Corinthians 9, starting with verse 19, I think. For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all, that I might win the more. And to the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might win Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law, though not being without the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those who are without law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that I may by all means save some. And I do all things for the sake of the gospel, that I may become a fellow partaker of it. Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win. And everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air. But I buffet my body and make it my slave, lest possibly, after I have preached to others, I myself should be disqualified. Okay, so let's look at this. Paul uses the analogy of an athlete here. An athlete has a goal. He wants to win the contest that he's in. He wants to win the race if he's running a race. And because he has that goal, he exercises self-control. There are things that he might want to do that otherwise he would be free to do, but he is not going to do it because it's going to interfere with his training. That he wants to, his goal is to win this race, and so he's going to exercise self-control in the way that he lives his life so that he can win the race. Well, as a believer, Paul has a goal. He wants to partake in the promises of the gospel. That is, he wants to find eternal life and live forever in the kingdom of God. That is his goal. So now, in addition to that, Paul is a believer in the gospel, but he is also an apostle who has been charged with preaching the gospel to Gentiles, preaching the gospel to Jews. What would it say about Paul if he preached the gospel to the Jews while he was eating a ham sandwich? Technically speaking, he would be doing what he had been told to do. He was being an apostle. He would be preaching the words of the gospel message to the Jews. But in his actions, he would be indicating that the gospel message doesn't mean much to Paul himself. The gospel is all about Jesus dying on the cross to bring us forgiveness and life. Paul would be telling the Jews this message. He would be telling them about the Jesus who sacrificed himself on the cross to bring them life, and yet Paul would care so little about them, these people for whom Christ died, that he is unwilling to limit his freedom so that they can hear the gospel without distraction. The ham sandwich means more to him than they do. He would be talking the gospel, but not really living it out himself personally. This is why Paul says, I do all things for the sake of the gospel, that I may become a fellow partaker of it. Paul is not just a messenger spouting information to the Jews. He is a man who wants Jesus to save him. He himself believes the gospel he is preaching. And so he limits his freedom because he values the gospel and wants the Jews to be able to hear it clearly. To not exercise self-control in such situations would be to show contempt for the very gospel he says he believes. Well, and then Paul is saying to the Corinthians that he wants them to exercise a similar self-control. On their own, they have perfect freedom to eat meat sacrificed to idols. But whenever their freedom might hurt another person, then they should live out the implications of the gospel that they say they believe. Nothing is more important than how a person relates to God. That is a life and death issue. So for them to entice another person to disobey God shows their own contempt for the gospel they say they believe. This is why self-control, in this case saying no to their desire to eat the meat, is necessarily connected with their faith. Okay, well, what's interesting to me about this example? I think this example helps us to see something about this connection between self-control and a genuine faith. So, because in this example, it's a little bit more complicated what we mean by self-control. We might be tempted to think that self-control is just the virtue of keeping the rules. We have rules, prohibitions that say, don't do X, don't do Y, don't do Z. So you're self-controlled if you're a person who doesn't do X, doesn't do Y, doesn't do Z. But I think there's more to it than that, ultimately. More fundamentally, self-control is about the gap between my desires and the truth. There's what I want, and then there's what's real, what's true. If I really believe the gospel, then certain things that I want to do are not worthy of me. They contradict what I say I believe. This can involve issues like sexual morality. It can involve issues of greed and materialism. It can involve issues like in this example, things that are okay in themselves. It's not that there's anything wrong with eating the meat in and of itself. But in the context in which they find themselves, they can't be committed to and following the gospel and disregard the impact of their actions on other people. So there is a self-control involved that's not a rule that they have to keep. It's just a recognition that I need to conform my life to the thing that I have given my life to. The gospel has called me to something. It has told me something about what is true, and I'm seeking to conform my life to that thing that I actually believe. Once again, the issue is whether my heart is open to the truth. Am I willing to acknowledge that my desires are not always right? They're just not always the right thing to do. This is what the false teachers are not willing to do. To just pull one example out of many, in 2:19, later in 2 Peter, he's going to say about these false teachers, "For speaking out arrogant words of vanity, they entice by fleshly desires, by sensuality, those who barely escape from the ones who live in error, promising them freedom while they themselves are slaves of corruption. For by what a man is overcome, by this he is enslaved." So they have gladly given themselves over to a slavery to sensuality and corruption instead of recognizing that God has called them to say no to themselves in certain ways and to pursue something different. The false teachers are committed to self-indulgence, not self-control. If the gospel message gets in the way of sensual indulgence, then it is the gospel that must change. Well, the believer will not go down that road. I'm not saying that believers always exercise self-control. You would not believe me if I told you that that's the truth. None of us is even close to controlling ourselves as we should. And we'll talk about that more a little bit later here. But if our hearts are open to the gospel, then they are open to the truth that we must at times say no to ourselves. The need for self-control is implied by the gospel that announces our salvation. We see self-control as a good thing. We want more of it. Okay, we'll talk a little bit more about that later on. Let me move to the next quality in the list and say a little bit about that, starting with verse 5 again. "Now for this very reason also, applying all diligence, in your faith provide moral excellence, and in your moral excellence knowledge, and in your knowledge self-control, and in your self-control perseverance." Perseverance is one of the key concepts in the entire New Testament, I think. We see it in very important teaching of all of the major teachers in the New Testament, starting with Jesus himself. And this is the idea. Many of you have heard me talk about this a lot because this is a concept that shows up in just about anywhere you look, you're going to bump into this. So sooner or later, you've heard me talk about this a number of times. But here's the picture as I have it. God has done a permanent work in the hearts of his people, a permanent work. Their hearts are permanently open to him and the truths of the gospel. Therefore, one of the most significant marks of the children of God is that they continue to believe. The work that he started, he finishes. More importantly, they continue to believe in the face of pressure not to believe. It is when the pressure is on, when the temptation is great to walk away from the whole thing, that the fact that we do not walk away is so significant. It's so significant that God deliberately puts us through difficult situations that the Bible refers to as trials in order to put that pressure on us. These trials force us to ask ourselves whether we truly believe the gospel, whether we truly want what the gospel promises. Maybe something more tempting is there, and we're wondering whether that is what we want more. Maybe to pursue the gospel is costing us in suffering in some way, and we don't want the suffering to continue. There are all sorts of things that it might be. It might be that we want something really much, and yet God has not given it to us. And we're asking ourselves the question, how can I trust this God who will not give me this thing that is so important to me? Many different kinds of trials we go through. In the midst of them, we struggle, we agonize, we curse, but in the end, we decide to stay with God. And that decision now, our faith is a more informed and purposeful faith because we have faced directly into the question, is this for me? And we have come out the other end saying, yes, this is for me. God puts us through these trials for our sake, not his. Through these tough times, we see that God has done this permanent work in our hearts. Why else did we stay when everything was pressuring us to leave? Okay, now I've given you here my little summary of this picture. We could spend this whole time, we could spend weeks looking at different passages that I would use to defend this picture that I just painted, that this is in fact a very strong biblical theme, that this is something that God does to his children, is takes us through trials that put the pressure on our faith so that the perseverance of our faith, the continuance of our faith, becomes something notable in us and something that we can look to as evidence that God is really doing a work in our lives. There are all sorts of passages we could go to start to build this picture. We could start with Jesus. One example is a very famous parable he tells about four different kinds of soil that a guy goes out and is casting seed, and the question in the story is, how does the seed respond in each of those different kinds of soil? And as you probably recall, the idea is that the sower is Jesus, who is sowing the word of the kingdom, the gospel message, and the soils are different kinds of hearts that respond to it. Some hearts show no interest at all in that gospel. Some show initial interest, but then are put off by persecution and fall away. Some show initial interest, but are distracted by the things of the world, by worldly wealth and pleasure and so on. And then there is that sort of heart, the good heart, that hears the message and perseveres. And Jesus uses that word, perseveres. In spite of the pressures and temptations, in the end, that heart has the gospel bear fruit in it, that ultimately it goes through to the end and the gospel has its intended effect in the heart of that person. Paul taught a similar thing. We could spend a lot of time talking about Romans 5, for example, where Paul gives this little progression. He says that we as believers rejoice, we glory in our trials. And why would we do that? Why would trials be something that we would glory in? Well, because in those trials, our faith is being tested, and the result is, for a believer, that ultimately, in the end, going through those trials, the result is perseverance. We hang in there with God. And the result of that, then, is what Paul would call proof. It is a state of being where it has been established. It has been shown. It's like I've been shaken and something has been demonstrated that there is some substance and reality to the faith that I have. And then he says that proof of our faith leads to hope. And that connection between trials of our faith, perseverance, a kind of proof that emerges from that, and hope, this is a very important theme, I think. The idea that ultimately our personal hope grows as we see our own faith being established and rooted in us, that it's strong enough to survive the winds that are blowing, that there is a great blessing that comes from that. There is a certain assurance that comes from seeing that God seems to have his hand on us because we have not fallen down as the winds were blowing. James talks about the same sort of thing. This is an important theme in the book of James. Peter, the author of the letter that we're studying here, spoke of similar things in the beginning of 1 Peter. He spoke of the trials of our faith as being like gold being tested in the fire. And that having our faith proven through these trials is valuable like that gold. I mean, it's incredibly valuable to have come through the trials that God takes us through with a faith that has survived. There's something incredibly valuable about that. And it is perseverance that is the mark of that. It is the fact that the more it is becoming clear to me what this is about, the more I still want it. So that my faith is knowledgeable and a reflection of my true desires. The more I come to see what it is, yes, I really do want that. I really do want to continue with that. So it's not surprising that in 2 Peter, Peter would include perseverance in the list of qualities that must accompany a genuine faith. Such things as faith, as he's been talking about, the pursuit of moral excellence, knowledge, self-control, these things are essential qualities, but they are not one-time events. They are something that in the end will persevere in us. We may struggle, we may fall short in many ways, but we never totally turn our back on these things. We always return to pick up the challenge again. Okay, so I'll say a little bit more about that at the end, but let me quickly say something about the last of the qualities in the list I want to look at today, and then I'll say something about the three of them. So we'll look at one more quality. Once again, I'll start with verse 5. Now, for this very reason also, applying all diligence in your faith, provide moral excellence, and in your moral excellence, knowledge, and in your knowledge, self-control, and in your self-control, perseverance, and in your perseverance, godliness. Notice that this ties us back to the very beginning of the letter. Peter had said that through his divine power, God has given us everything pertaining to life and godliness. Now, like many of the words in Peter's list, this is a word not used often in the New Testament, but is very familiar in the Gentile Greek culture. The word means having a reverent devotion to the gods, to be godly, pious, devout, which often in that cultural context might include a devotion to the emperor who represents the divinity to the people of the country or something like that. Now, when this word is used in the New Testament, naturally, the focus shifts to devotion to the one God, the creator of heaven and earth, the Father of Jesus Christ. So it's not a general devotion to the gods, but it is a particular devotion to God, the creator. So this is one of those words that's a little bit tricky. I actually find each of the words in lists like this to be tricky to work with because by themselves they just sit there and, okay, so what is it exactly that this is getting at? What does this add to Peter's list? If he had not put it here, what would be missing? What does he think that he has included here? Like I say, it's not used a lot in the New Testament, so what is the feel of it? Well, this is what I would conclude right now about why the word is here. I think Peter is making explicit what has been implicit in his list up until now. I mean, I have been bringing it out in each of the things that we've looked at, but that is, he is making explicit that God is the focus of these virtues that we're looking at here. As we have seen, most of the words in Peter's list would have been seen as virtues by enlightened pagans. Concepts like moral excellence, knowledge, self-control were virtues that were celebrated by other people other than Christians at the time. But notice these can end up being fairly human-centered. We pursue virtue and self-control because it is a better way to live. Life goes better if you pursue virtue. Life goes better if you control yourself. You can feel better about yourself if you are a person who exercises self-control. Knowledge rather than ignorance enriches one's life, and so on. Now, it's not that there's anything necessarily wrong with that. As far as it goes, it's fine. But as I've been trying to say along the way, when Peter uses these, when the New Testament refers to these sorts of virtues, it's always a richer idea because all of these virtues are being understood in the light of our relationship to God. It is the fact that God is there and that he is a particular sort of God and that he has certain values and that there are certain responses that are appropriate to a God like that. That's the idea that is behind these words. Well, the word godliness, I think, in Peter's list, it seems to me right now, what it does is it brings that explicitly into it. That we're not just talking about morality, we are talking about being devout, about being not just a good person in being self-controlled and treating other people well, but that I am relating rightly to God. That God is, in fact, the focus of the moral efforts of my life. The goal of the gospel, after all, as Peter has defined it, is to make us like God himself. Godliness, then, is that state of bowing in submission to God, seeing him as above us, seeing his promises as true and valuable, seeing his character as our guide. If that's true, once again, we cannot be people of faith, people who believe the gospel, without pursuing godliness. In the gospel, God has pointed the way to himself. He himself is the standard that we are hoping to one day live up to. We are not called to live lives of abstract virtue. We are called to believe God, submit to God, trust God, emulate God. The greatest commandment, Jesus says, is the commandment to love God with all your heart and soul and mind. To pursue the love of God is to pursue godliness. That's why godliness is in this list and why it's important, because it turns our attention to the one in all of this who is most important. And of course, the false teachers are not pursuing godliness. Instead, Peter numbers them among the ungodly. They have no real intention to follow and submit to their creator. Okay, so I have a few final comments I want to make. We've seen three items in Peter's list: self-control, perseverance, and godliness. I just want to say a few more things about each of those qualities. Regarding self-control, I should be honest with you. I mean, I feel a little bit like a fraud. I'm giving you this description of how important self-control is and everything, but in my entire life as a believer, every time I come across these passages that talk about self-control, I flinch, and I swallow hard, and I start to get nervous, because I've found the concept of self-control to be both attractive but also scary. And the reason is probably not hard to figure out. It's not that I don't believe in the value of it. It's just that I cannot pretend to have attained to it as I should. I mean, as I look at my life, I can tell you that there are times when I do not exercise self-control. And that is a great sorrow to me, but when I see it as a list of the necessary qualities that accompany the believer, it makes you stop and think, which I think it's intended to do. Now, after all, I mean, I think this should be a fairly universal experience. Every sin is a kind of lack of self-control. I ought to have power over my choices and choose to do the right thing. When it is clear the difference between what I want and where I ought to go, then I ought to exercise self-control and do the thing that I ought and not the thing that I want. But that's not always the way it turns out. If the biblical authors mean that a true believer will always exercise power and control over his or her behavior, will always say no to the wrong and say right and say yes to the right, then I'm in big trouble if that's what they're saying, because that does not describe my life. And as I look around me, the other believers I know, it seems to me, are in big trouble as well, because perfection in this area does not seem to be a noticeable quality as I look around. But I think we have reason to believe that Peter and the other biblical authors, while saying something very sobering and important and necessary, are not saying something quite as bad as that. For one thing, notice that Peter is going to end his list by saying, "For if these qualities are yours and increasing." He seems to picture that regarding self-control, for example, We will start out with little, and it will grow. So Peter is not a perfectionist. He's not saying that perfect self-control is the mark of the believer. But he does believe that self-control must be a meaningful part of our lives. As we often talk about around here, I would see the key to understanding this, understanding that there are two realities in the life of the Christian. Reality number one, we are sinners and will always feel the pull of selfishness and evil, and sometimes we give into it. And reality number two, our hearts are genuinely open to God. We believe what he tells us and want what he has promised. The tension between these two realities is what defines our experience with a quality like self-control. Because we struggle with our own evil, we will often not control ourselves as much as we should. But we also genuinely trust God and genuinely desire to be like him, and those desires are growing. So we will fight against our evil desires and strive to control ourselves. We value self-control, the idea that I would say no to myself to pursue what is ultimately right and good and life-giving, ultimately. That's a good thing. That's what I want. That ought to be what I want. So the Christian is not marked by unbroken success at self-control. The Christian is marked by a growing desire for self-control, which will sometimes translate itself into actual self-control. We want to submit to what is right. We want to be like God. We recognize when we are not controlling ourselves and regret it and seek to do differently. And when I say we want these things, I even want to add that it is ultimately that we will want these things. In the midst of our own trials in life, there may be a season where we refuse to think about the demands of self-control. You may have had such an experience yourself, where there's a time when you just don't want to look at the implications of the way you're treating someone or something. You just don't want to go there. And so the idea of saying no to yourself is not really an option. You won't go there. But God will not let us rest with that, ultimately, in his mercy. Ultimately, he will break through and show us the truth. It's part of this process of going through these trials is that ultimately we wake up and come to recognize what it is that's really going on. So we're talking about a quality that grows not in a linear or exponential fashion in our lives. It has fits and starts as the reality of our own weaknesses confront the trials that God takes us through. But we are growing in our commitment to it, in our wanting to be that. And that will have an impact, ultimately, on the way we make decisions in our lives. The false teachers that Peter is warning against are very far from that. They're not struggling to do good and failing, as he describes them here. They are justifying and pursuing a life of self-indulgence. They want what they want, and they're finding a way of teaching and urging others to live that is protecting and fostering the kind of self-indulgence that they want to pursue. And that is a very serious thing. If we refuse to admit that we need to fight against our own sinfulness, then we do have a serious problem. We may, and we always will, struggle with saying no to ourselves, but if we are unwilling to acknowledge that we need to say no to ourselves and we need to fight to do that, then there's a question as to what this gospel means to us, ultimately. Okay, as far as this second quality, perseverance, is concerned, I just want to reemphasize what I said before. The fact that perseverance is a mark of the true Christian is actually a great gift to us. Since we are all still sinners, we can't expect moral perfection to be the mark of the believer. And if that were the mark of the believer, if you could not have assurance until sin has been consistently conquered in your life, there is no sin for an extended period of time, and basically never again, if that was the mark of the believer, then it would be very difficult to find assurance that I belong to God. Examining my moral success can only lead to discouragement, since I am never as good as I ought to be. There's always more. There is always something more, some other way that I could be even better than I am, ways that I have not yet tamed my own selfishness that still need to be dealt with. Even for a mature believer who is living a very moral sort of life, we still know we are not what we ought to be. But God's people can examine their lives over the years and see his hand upon them. It is the fact that God has taken us through those times where it has become clear to us what following the gospel may cost us, who God is, what he is going to do for us, and what he is not going to do for us. And we've confronted all of those things, and we have seen God faithfully preserving us in the midst of that. Through many dangers, toils, and snares, I have already come. 'Tis grace has led me safe thus far, and grace will lead me home. It is seeing that God has kept his hand on me in the midst of the dangers, toils, and snares that gives me the assurance. It's not assurance from my wonderfulness. It is assurance that comes from seeing God's faithful hand on me, keeping me in the game when I was trying to take myself out of the game. Trials and perseverance are God's way of comforting us and making us serious people. He is forcing us to confront our faith, to embrace the implications of our faith, to live out our faith. And by his grace, we are doing so. And when we see that over the years, then that can give us assurance. So the idea that perseverance is in this list as one of those qualities that must accompany faith is ultimately not a discouraging idea. To me, at least, it's an encouraging idea because I have the opportunity to look at what God has done. Finally, let me say one last thing about this quality of godliness. Peter, in this list, is calling us to embrace a moral vision, but God is at the center of that vision. And let me just say again, it's quite possible to believe in virtue and self-control and knowledge and such things without believing in God. There have been many people, there are today, many people who would celebrate the concept of moral excellence and self-control and things like that, who are quite bitterly opposed to the idea of God. Because we're made in the image of God, we recognize the appeal of those things. We are made to recognize that there's something good in controlling yourself and treating other people well and that sort of thing. Life goes better when we treat other people well. Life goes better when we control our animal passions and live temperate lives. We can feel better about ourselves when we are following that road instead of not. But by itself, this kind of thinking is not enough. It is ultimately hollow and sterile. The central issue for human beings is whether they will return to their Creator. It's not just being good. It's will we give God the gratitude, trust, and obedience that he deserves. This is a moral vision with the right and appropriate center to it. That is God. So we love our neighbor, but ultimately we love our neighbor because God has called us to love our neighbor, and God himself is love. We control our sexual behavior not just because there are bad consequences that come when we don't control our sexual behavior, but because we recognize that God made us as sexual beings, and he knows what he made it to be. He knows what it is all about. We control our behavior because we recognize that God knows and has called us to be certain kinds of people with the gifts that he has given us. I think just as it is easy to forget God altogether, it is easy to go through life and just kind of forget about God, it is also easy to be moral people and forget about God. Just pat me on the head because I'm a good little boy. I'm the kind of person you want to have around. You don't have to worry about me. I'm not going to do anything weird or strange. I'm going to behave myself. I'm going to be well-socialized. I'm going to do the right thing. But our goal is not just goodness, but godliness. We believe that God is really there. We are pursuing him. And in pursuing God, we cannot help but pursue goodness. So I think the inclusion of godliness in this list is important, although it's a very vague sort of word that might sound like it doesn't mean much. I think that Peter is trying to point us to the fact that ultimately it's not just about being good, but it is about orienting ourselves, relating ourselves to our God in the appropriate way, to take our place under him, thanking him, worshiping him, because he is who he is. Godliness is an essential part of being a person of faith, because we have our faith in the God who has revealed himself in the gospel. It's not just a message to be good. It is God has shown who he is and who he is in relation to us. To be godly is to take our place, our appropriate place under him, and say, yes, that's where I belong. You up there, me here. Okay, so we can take a few minutes of questions.
Thank you very much, Ron. That was very helpful and interesting. I had a question back when you were talking about self-control and talking about, these are my words maybe, but refraining from exercising certain freedoms that we would have in the gospel depending on who's around us and their thoughts and all that. I wonder if you could make some comments about that topic as it relates to the maybe another side of that, which might be if we don't exercise freedom, well, if we do exercise our freedom, it actually might not be a bad thing if somebody else has a misunderstanding of the gospel. In fact, it might be the right thing and a good thing,
right?
You know, along the lines of Paul and Peter and all that jazz. And if you don't want to address that, that's fine, but I just was curious.
No, that's a very good question. I mean, you understand. I mean, we could have spent the whole time looking at that passage in 1 Corinthians and trying to tease out all the implications of it.
This is not a criticism of
But before I answer your question, let me make it clear that I was giving that as an example. It's one kind of self-control that we might be called upon to exercise. That is, that not that there's some particular rule that we're breaking or anything like that, but just looking at the situation that I am in. If I were not in this situation, I would be free to do something, but the fact is I am in this situation, so my actions are going to have impacts on other people that I have to take into account when I'm doing that. There's an easy answer to what you're saying, the issue you're raising, Dave. I mean, it's hard to kind of fill it out and put all the picture together. I've always thought about that issue in terms of the way Paul dealt with the issue of circumcision, say, the fact that he himself had Timothy circumcised before they went out to preach the gospel together, but Paul insisted that he would not allow Titus to submit to circumcision when he was being pressured by the Judaizers to do so. And I would say that the one example for Timothy being a half-Jew, Paul is basically saying to Timothy, you have the opportunity to take advantage of the fact that you are a half-Jew. You could conform to Jewish practices, not to communicate that you have to conform to Jewish practices to be saved, but in order to get a hearing with them. But if it comes to that point where they start insisting to you, Timothy, that, well, it's sure a good thing that you were circumcised because, of course, you couldn't be saved if you weren't, then we know that Paul would respond with the sort of thing that he did with the Judaizers, saying, no, not at all. So the question is, what is the issue at stake? Is it, am I going to limit my freedoms in a way that will help the other person? Or do I think, in fact, that in this situation, for me to limit my freedom would not help them? And I think that's what Paul would say in the Judaizer situation. I would be communicating the wrong thing. To submit to them, in this case, would not be making it easier for them to hear the gospel. It would be making it harder for them to hear the gospel, because in this case, this is confronting them right at the spot where they need to be confronted. So, yeah, it's not that giving in to other people is always the right thing to do. What is always the right thing to do is to pursue love. That is, what is in the best interests of the other person, under the understanding that I would have as to what is truly valuable given by God. So,
right. So it's taking, as you said before, it's taking into account what the likely impact would be in a certain situation. So it sounds like what you're saying is, as well as we can, a way to approach it is to think about what we would discern or guess to be the likely impact in a given situation, depending on the other people's perspectives and what they think the gospel really is. Obviously, the gospel isn't ultimately whether we eat meat or not. And if somebody thinks that, that might lead to one thing. But if somebody doesn't really think that, but you might want to refrain anyway because for whatever reason. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, as you say, our best understanding. It might be that Paul, when he's going to talk to the Jews, he might have come to a particularly sort of liberal and enlightened group of Jews who don't have all that big a deal with the ham sandwich. I don't know if there were such Jews back at that time. There are today. I don't know if there were back then, but maybe there were. So maybe his care to not offend them in that case, he wouldn't have even needed to do it because for this particular group, that wasn't going to bother them. I doubt that that was true, but maybe it could be the case. So the issue is, I am called upon, I mean, this is what we'll talk about next week, but I am called upon to love, which means to pursue the good of other people. I'm not God, so I can't just magically distribute good on everybody. I don't always know what it is, you know, what is the best thing, and I can't control other people. Paul says his goal was to make it so that he might, by all means, save some. And he's acknowledging it's not the fact that I didn't eat a ham sandwich with the Jews that's going to save them. I mean, many of them will walk away from the gospel anyway. And ultimately, it is God's work in them that is going to be what's really going to determine what's going on. But still, I'm preaching the gospel. I want to preach the gospel with my actions as well as my words, or else I don't really care that much about the gospel and about them.
Thank you very much.
No stumbling blocks.
Yes.
Two questions, just some minor technical question. The phrase, in your faith.
Yes.
I'm overanalyzing it, but in.
Right.
Tease that out a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think of it as like, we use that kind of phrase. I mean, if you stop to try to think, okay, in your faith, so here's my faith, and I put in it, or something like that. But I might say to you, in saying this to you, I don't mean to imply. It's just a way of referring to the fact that, okay, this is something that I'm doing, but now I'm qualifying it further. And I think it's something like that. That is, having faith, okay, I've said I'm writing to people who have believed this same gospel that I do, okay, and that I'm telling you that the message that you have believed is about God and his power ultimately bringing us into life and godliness, making like us like himself. So your situation is that you believe this thing that I teach, okay, as far as it goes. I mean, you would sign on and say, yeah, okay, I'll buy that. Well, in that then, that needs to go farther. This faith that you have, it can't stand alone. It ought to lead to this thing. I don't know what the best way to paraphrase that is. I thought about that back in the first week when I was talking about this stuff. But like I say, I think it's just a way of saying, given that you are a person who has these beliefs, then let this be true as well. Something like that.
And the word translated godliness?
Yes.
I'm kind of wondering about where that comes from, because brotherly kindness, love, self-control, perseverance, moral excellence, godliness seems either redundant or it sort of encapsulates all of those.
Yes. But, well, that's why I say, I mean, yes, it encapsulates them in a sense, in that at the beginning he said that the purpose of this God in the gospel is giving us everything that pertains to life and godliness. And there the word godliness, I think, is sort of capturing the whole, you know, it is my life lived under God with all of the qualities that come from a life appropriately lived in a right relationship with God. But what I think it adds to the list is that we are talking about not just an abstract morality, not a moralism or anything, but we are talking about a response to God. I mean, I think each of the things in the list, if you understand them correctly, they imply the other things in the list, which is why I think in each case he's saying, by saying the next thing in the list, he's saying, and let me fill out, don't stop with a short, truncated picture of this thing that I just said. It's a full picture that I mean, and it includes this next thing that I'm going to say. So everything he said up to that point, understanding what he meant, it all implied godliness. But by putting the word godliness in, he's filling it out and saying, don't let those other words get shrunk down to just kind of an abstract morality. We're talking about genuine piety here, genuine devotion to God, that sort of thing.
So the godliness is not the imitation. Well, it is. He's not saying primarily the imitation of God's character as much as he's saying living in a place where you realize your place before God.
I think so. I mean, clearly at the beginning, he talks about God's power making us like him so that we come to share the divine nature. I don't think that godliness itself, that word, quite means that. It's more that idea of being one who bows the knee to God, who takes my appropriate place and lives in a way that is appropriate with that. It ultimately involves being like God, but it implies this stance that I have taken toward God, I think. It's tough. I mean, it's tough to say. And it can be tricky. How much has the word changed in its use in the New Testament from the way it was used in the general culture around it, or in classical Greek literature and stuff? I mean, most of these words are words that end up a lot in like Plato and Aristotle and Philo and different folks like that, and each of them has their own kind of spin on it. Each of them sees something as being at the heart of that's a little different than what the other person does. Well, in the New Testament, I think the New Testament authors see something at the heart of this that's different than what Plato would have necessarily, or what Aristotle would have. And yet, there are things in common. They're using the same word, and there are aspects that are in common between them. When the word is not used much in the New Testament, at least for me, it makes it hard to be real dogmatic about what exactly the flavor it has, because you don't have enough examples of it to be able to say definitively, yeah, this is what was going on. What I have said is what makes the most sense to me given what I've seen so far.
So I have two background questions. And okay. If you've already talked about these, we can talk about them some other time.
Okay, or maybe I don't know.
Okay, well, that's fine too.
Okay.
What's the link between 1 Peter and 2 Peter?
Okay. Well, they both claim to be written by a guy named Peter. It is debated as to whether 2 Peter actually is written by Peter, but I said at the beginning of this that I think it is written by Peter. There is not a lot of connection between it. In 2 Peter, he says at one point, this is the second time that I'm writing to you, which kind of makes you think, oh, that's 1 Peter that he's talking about, which would mean that this is also being written to churches in Asia Minor, which is where 1 Peter was written to. The thing that strikes me is that the two letters are addressing different sorts of problems. 1 Peter is fundamentally addressing the problem of how do I respond in the midst of the trials, in particular, the trials that have come upon them for being believers. That it is hard to be a woman believer married to an unbelieving man. It is hard to be a Christian citizen under a government that is not sympathetic to Christianity, and those sorts of things. So the focus of that letter is for them to keep the hope that they have in mind and as a guide as they are sorting themselves out as to how are they going to respond to this stuff. 2 Peter seems to be all about a different sort of problem, and that is the fact that there have come among them those that Peter would call false teachers. And they seem to be a licentious bunch. They are modeling and advocating sensuality, greed, self-indulgence, and that kind of thing. So two different sorts of problems, perhaps written to the same group. That's part of what people debate about whether the second letter is written by the first guy because it doesn't seem to be addressing the same issues. But that seems to imply that one writer would only address one kind of problem in his life, and that doesn't seem very likely. So I don't have a problem with that. But otherwise, there are some similarities in themes. I mean, 1 Peter emphasizes eschatology, that is, looking forward to the coming of Jesus and our hope in that way. And 2 Peter also emphasizes that. So there are some things that tie them together. And your second question?
My second question has to do with the false teachers. When I was growing up, any time false teachers came up, it was obviously about Gnosticism.
Right.
And since I have hung out here more, it becomes more obvious that false teachers are usually Judaizers.
Mm-hmm.
So this doesn't seem to fit into either of those.
Mm-hmm.
So you just said they're interested in sensuality. So could you comment on, are those the only two groups that show up in the New Testament, actually, the Judaizers and these kind of sin? Because it seems like other places, they do talk about folks who are interested in, like, license.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or this, like, very prudish kind of.
Okay. Number one, I'm not the world's expert historian or anything, but I'm not convinced that Gnosticism ever really shows up as a problem in the New Testament. I mean, Gnosticism as we know it is something that happened later. And whenever you see anything in the New Testament that points to something that the problem people out there thought that has anything that sounds like it's Gnosticism, they say, aha, it's proto-Gnosticism. There it is, right there. I don't know that that's necessarily the case. Now, the first thing that people learn about Gnosticism, if you know anything about Gnosticism, you probably know that the word Gnostic comes from the word gnosis, which means knowledge. So we think Gnosticism has to do with thinking that there's a special knowledge that you gain, you know, and you find enlightenment and some sort of salvation through that ultimately. The problem is, of course, that Peter himself emphasizes knowledge. I mean, he's talked about it several times in the span of six verses here, and basically saying that this knowledge of God is leading to being like God, and I mean, all kinds of stuff that you could think, well, that sounds like Gnosticism. The idea that knowledge has something to do with our salvation is not Gnosticism at all. I mean, that's not what we're talking about. Why is it that someone would pursue sensuality? That is, besides the fact that it feels good and I want to. What is the intellectual state of a person who is pursuing indulging the body? And as I would understand it, Gnosticism has this hierarchy where the material, the physical, is essentially evil and is transcending that and going back away from the material back to the higher place, you know, and it's this knowledge that allows you to do that. So if you think that the material is bad, as I would understand it, there are two ways you could go with that. You could think, therefore, I need to downplay the material altogether and not indulge in any physical, sensual experience at all because the physical is totally wrong and bad, and so it can lead to an asceticism. Or it can lead to indulgence because since the physical doesn't matter, it doesn't matter what I do with my body. I can do anything with it, and that doesn't matter because the material is already messed up. It is getting to this enlightened place. So Paul in 1 Corinthians saying that the body is for the Lord is a significant thing, that he's saying that God made the physical body and intended it to reflect his character and purposes and stuff. So you can't say that it doesn't matter what you do with your body. So in Peter we see license and self-indulgence for the false teachers. So you could say, aha, this is a result of that Gnostic emphasis that the body is bad. But the thing is, there's nothing in 2 Peter that says that. They're sensualists, I mean, as they're described. And it might just be that they're sensualists because they like it and they want to do it. And they never had a Gnostic thought in their lives about material bodies being bad or good or anything like that. I don't know. So my answer is I don't know, really. It's hard at this point. I'm going to be looking at this more and thinking about it more. I'm not done thinking about it. But right now, it doesn't seem to me that 2 Peter gives us many clues about the theological framework, the philosophical framework of the false teachers. What he's concerned with is whatever framework has led them to that spot, they have divorced the pursuit of goodness from whatever thoughts of God and whatever that they have. And that's a terrible thing. And he's trying to make that connection back.
But these people are probably not Judaizers.
Well, yeah, there doesn't seem to be much evidence of that either. James is another letter. When you look at the problems that he's addressing in the church, it doesn't really seem to be Judaizing that he's concerned with. It's not people who are arguing you have to be Jewish or you have to keep the Jewish law or something like that. It's just people, although they say they believe the gospel, they're unwilling to see any connection between that gospel and the way that they live. That's kind of the sort of thing that Peter is getting at as well, I think, is that if this stuff is true, it implies something about what I have embraced and how I'm going to live. And that's really his concern. I mean, it's a very moral concern that he has in this thing. If you believe this stuff, then God is a certain way, and you want to be like that God, and so it's going to have an effect on what you pursue and what you are about. And that's kind of that's at the heart of it, I think. Okay, well, we'll stop at that.